On this episode, we're going all the way back to October 2019 to bring to you, from our vault, Turn On The Bright Lights by Interpol. There's a lot of spirited conversation this episode, which makes it a particularly good listen, even now. But also, this kind of relates tangentially somewhat to REM. REM get a few mentions in the episode, but also, Interpol are quite a big band, and it's really difficult to call them unsung, I think. Obviously, they're not as big as REM. That would be bananas for me to say that. But this album was quite well regarded at the time and went on to sell quite a lot of records. Again, not as many as REM, but a fair amount. So yeah, I hope you enjoy this little flashback to 2019. This is Turn On The Bright Lights by Interpol.
Hello, audience.
Hello, audience.
We are here to throw ourselves at your feet and request ongoing financial assistance. David has now joined me in the ranks of people with giant gaping holes in the crotches of our breeks. And Mark will no doubt not be far behind.
It's an epidemic. It's happening one person at a time.
Yeah, to underfinanced podcasters. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how you can tell us in the street.
If you see a ball.
Yeah, if you catch sight of just a wee little ball, plus the fact that all podcasters are white men anyway, yeah. So it's very unlikely you'll see anything other than a ball. Yeah. But yeah, so help us at least mend the hole in our jeans.
Yeah, if you give us enough money, we can then start our next podcast project, which is the Crotchless Podcast.
I'm not asking for a new pair of trousers. I'm just going to patch it up.
A darn. You just need a darn. Yeah.
So I mean,
so the way to do that is
that like $8 maybe at the Polish tailor.
Yeah. Yeah. So that would be 4 new Patreon subscribers.
Yeah. Can we have 4 new Patreon subscribers, please? We had a great rally in that first couple of weeks. We would really love to keep up that momentum because it's letting us hit those targets. It's letting us do things like we're now arguing almost daily about the design of the merchandise, which is.
I'm trying to find a studio.
Positive development. Yeah. So please, if you haven't subscribed, we assure you there is worthwhile stuff coming your way.
But you do get good stuff, like you get the normal episode 2 days early.
Yeah, you get the normal episode.
Extra bonus
early.
Episodes.
Bonus episodes.
Is that Split 7-inch out, Mark?
Split 7-inch is out, yes.
Yep. So there's
Best closing tracks.
Yep, best closing tracks of all time, as suggested by listeners. So there's a lot of kind of additional stuff there. We'd really love it if you would go on Patreon, just set something up. And that way, even if you take a few weeks out and you come back and then binge us for a while, you know that we're at least getting ongoing funding and we can keep doing it while you're on your sabbatical. So, Mark, I think we've got something to thank.
Yeah, so we'd like to thank Tim Russell this week for giving us some of his hard-earned cash.
So what are we going to do for Tim? Does he get an anthem? What does he get?
No, he just gets a shout-out and his name and lights. So we're going to add a bit on the website soon where we'll list all the names of all the lovely people that have given us money.
Okay, and those of you that are due anthems, playlists, merchandise...
It's all coming.
It's all coming, yeah.
It's a lot of work. We've kind of made too much work for ourselves.
But yeah, thanks for funding us. Thanks for listening. We're going to get out your road and let the future selves take over with the rest of the podcast.
Great, thanks, bye.
Man, we're in the future now. Holy shit.
Oh,
how did that just happen?
This is a podcast.
Digital podcast times.
Tonight, everything I say, I will say it in a baritone register.
Oh, dear. How are you this week, Chris?
I have been listening to this all week.
Me too.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, it's been really exciting.
What changed?
Not a fucking lot, mate.
He's shown his hand too early.
Yeah. Did you actually go see some bands this week, Chris?
I went to see some less than exemplary metal in Edinburgh. Glasgow's slightly strange little brother.
Yeah, slightly posher.
A very posh brother, yeah.
But the final band of the evening was excellent. They were called Exterminator. No, they were called Eliminator. And they played a form of heavy metal popularized in Birmingham.
What about you, Dave?
I supported Mixmaster Mike on Sunday.
Oh, so you did? Fuck, how's that?
So it was fun. I was tremendously hungover. I had 2 hours sleep. And I watched Mixmaster Mike's soundcheck. And he is not subtle. He is very fast at doing the decks. And then everything he does is very loud. It's like, hey, oh, boom, 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 hey, woo, ah, huh, huh, come on, guys, party, party, and I was just absolutely hanging my tits off. So, but I had a nice time. I just played an hour and a half of dank hip hop and then
fucked off,
ran away, and fell asleep. So, but yeah, I could now put that on my CV. So that was fun.
Did you see him?
I saw him in the
like his set.
I like a good 10 minutes of it before I left and thought, no, this is exactly what my hangover does not need.
Oh, that's a shame.
But apparently, it was very good.
Where was he playing?
St. Luke's.
Okay.
So, aye, it was nice and busy. People out on a Sunday night ready for a hip-hop party.
Nice.
I was not...
People love a... people love a hip-hop.
People love to hip-hop in a church.
Do they have any MCs with him? No, you know?
No, just him.
Cool.
Just him and his mixer going mental.
I think it's a shame Dave doesn't get hungover more often these days because... He's good value when he's hungover. You never know what you're going to get.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, no, it's a much rarer occasion now. But yeah. When they do happen, they...
You save them up.
...truly happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Mark, and yourself, did you see anything that lit your world on fire?
Well, after the last episode, I ran away and watched Touche Amore and Def Heaven in the garage, and it was pretty good. Touche Amore were great. Def Heaven were really good. A lot of effects on his voice. So much fucking reverb. It was so high in the mix as well, so it sounded really strange because they're a black-ish metal band.
Yeah, my pal saw them in London like 2 days later and said that he was obviously just fully coked up as well, so I don't know if he was...
Clearly very coked up, man. His eyes were like fucking... Wow.
Wow, cool.
They were just...
Allegedly.
...like saucers the whole time. Well, he loved to party, apparently, but I'll tell you about that later on.
Oh, wait a minute.
Hey!
That's for the subscribers. You get the adult version of the podcast.
No, but I actually really enjoyed them. They played for an hour. I didn't think they were that dull. I know you didn't think you think they were dull.
I mean, that's... For me, that's good by their standards, yeah.
Pretty intense, but it was cool. It was really busy as well. And it was in the garage.
Yeah, so the world's full of mugs.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Tell you what I did do. I saw Joker this week and I did not think it was possible for a film to live up to that much hype, and it really did. It's fucking tremendous.
Do you really enjoy it?
Oh, it's really spectacular, and the performance is absolutely astonishing. I've been known to be a touch cynical at times, but goddamn, it was really, really, really good. Yeah. I think some of the negative reviews, reading them now, they're a little bit too cool for school. You know, as a fellow contrarian, as Biffy Clyro's tour manager will tell you, I sometimes like to put people's noses out of joint just because, you know.
So you are the backlash against the backlash against the backlash.
It seems like I've gone meta.
Yeah.
You're the frontlash.
Meta. Yeah.
Yeah, I've yet to see it, but I really would like to go see it. So I think I'm going to rectify that this weekend.
It's a tremendous piece of work. It really is. I noticed some people like losing their shit because there's a Gary Glitter tune in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there's bigger problems because, you know, it really encapsulates incel culture in a movie. It's fucking great at that. I think people are upset about that. I don't see why. It's already something that exists in this film's like, okay, you see the parallels. So
not pointing it out.
Yeah, do something about it.
It's pointing it out, not celebrating
exactly.
It.
Exactly. Ignoring it doesn't fucking make it better.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Great. So, oh, well.
Kudos to them for fucking... pulling that off. That was...
So it's sort of based on a rainy, miserable version of New York City, isn't it?
No, I mean, most of the Batman films are based on a really miserable version of New York City. This isn't
Yeah,
so
I'm
much...
trying to do a segue into the band that we're covering.
Right. A really miserable version of New York City, you say, David?
Yes.
Funnily enough, it was very in keeping with the subject of this week's podcast.
Thanks very much. Oh, well practiced.
That was not at all planned either. Like, I love how these things just sometimes happen on this show.
So organic.
New York City.
So this week we are going to discuss the album Turn On the Bright Lights by the band Interpol. And I think this is easily one of the best indie albums of this century. Fortunately, we're at the start of the century still, kind of, so we're able to say that. Mm. But notwithstanding, it was part of a renaissance that happened at the start of the 2000s for indie music, especially in New York City, with bands like Strokes and the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, these guys. You had a band called Long Wave to a slightly lesser extent, and around about the same time, you had bands like The Killers and stuff who were popularising it. By the way, something that maybe didn't need to happen is the Killers cover of Obstacle Number One that you can find on YouTube. It's not awful, but then the later you get in the track, you're like, ah, Brandon, where are you going with that? That's just not doing anyone any favours. But yeah, I mean, they were part of this uptick in like really interesting indie music. I think Arcade Fire were kind of really pushing through around at the same time. And yet, even with that kind of fairly stiff competition, that this album is, for me, like a really high bar. It's very retro, I kind of unabashedly retro, but with a very distinct sort of post-punk. And even at times in the arrangements, sort of takes cues from like post-hardcore. The guitars are very separated. They spiral in and out of each other. So rather than playing just chords, they fragment the chords between each other. It's something that Interpol became very well known for. And curiously enough, have sort of abandoned now because they've trimmed down to three-piece. So they don't really have these... The way the songs are written is much more simple. And I don't know if it's necessarily worked in their favour, but we'll get to that. My main reservation about choosing this was... it's incredibly, incredibly critically revered.
Yeah, it's not really unsung at all.
Well, wait a minute though. It's incredibly critically revered. It's like 9.5 in Pitchfork and...
number 20 in their best of 2000s
list. Yeah, generally across the board. But at the same time, it's an album that did not even close to crack the top 100. And I think that's worth taking into consideration because the subsequent albums, Antics, which is a very fucking good record, and Our Love to Admire... that got to number two at one point. So commercially, the band's success followed on the back of the strength of this album as they acquired credibility. And indeed, like I was looking through their past shows. We'll talk about this a wee bit as well. But they very quickly went from playing King Tut's to selling out the Barrowlands. I mean, in the space of 2 months. This was a band that just critically rocketed out of nowhere. And then the success sort of followed much more steadily. But in recent years... they have strayed quite far from that path. Yeah, I mean, straight off the bat, I mean, you obviously gave it away, but this doesn't seem like a band you'd listen to much, Mark.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's not a band I would really listen to at all.
So now that you've been forced to, Mark.
Whatever. It's, aye.
This is what you tune in for, folks.
that's how they make me feel. Like, that's the music, that's what it sounds like to me. It's like, no, all right, cool. You do that. It's so devoid of anything like passion for me. No passion. Feels completely cold, sterile, emotionless. It's just not for me at all.
I think it falls... they're a band that fall into this valley of indie music that I quite often find myself avoiding because I love big pop bangers.
Yeah.
And then I love weird, obtuse, progressive metal. And... you know, everything in between that. But then there's a valley in there where there's bands doing simple indie rock and they're trying to do hooks, but they don't have the joy or the outbursts of colour that pop has. but then they don't have like the interesting progressive musicality of more interesting stuff. So for me, I've never listened to Interpol because they just don't excite me in that they're not progressive enough in one way, but they're not hooky enough in another way. I can completely understand why they are revered for people that don't like challenging music, but like to pretend they're into cool music, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there will clearly be people fucking tearing their hair out at both of you guys.
Yeah,
because I mean,
yeah.
First of all, Interpol, for people that like them, certainly within the realms of indie music, they are extremely progressive. The chord changes, I mean, indeed, it's something they've been criticised for, is that their chord selection is sometimes too unorthodox. The phrase that comes up a lot is sour. They use a lot of jazz chords, diminished chords, minor to minor progressions, which is a very prog thing to do. And the way that they break up the lines, the division, this, like I said, the post-hardcore, post-punk division of notes, rather than playing bar chords or solid chords, one guy playing two or three parts maybe higher up the register, the other playing two or three parts lower down, you know, the syncopation of those parts, their approach to the arrangements musically is extremely inventive. And their bass player, Carlos Dengler, certainly the bass player up to the fourth album, was a phenomenon. I mean, a guy who never played bass, who grew up listening to like Def Leppard and Dokken and all these, and Maiden, bands like this, who just completely seamlessly transitioned. He never owned a bass. This guy was in Interpol, he was touring like festivals and arenas. In his whole life, he never owned a bass. He said when the band got enough money, they bought a bass. He'd only ever borrowed one. And since he left the band, he's never played one again. Yet the guy's still considered to be one of the great contemporary, certainly pop and rock bassists. His stuff is astonishingly inventive for an indie band. And certainly the earlier the album, the louder the bass was in the mix, which is something they're faulted for, certainly mixing that down as they went on. But when you can really hear Carlos, it's often him that's making the songs. It's often him driving some of the most unusual parts, some of the kind of bridging segues, some of the little dropouts. They're all about him. And this is a guy who's just picked this thing up. He's a really fascinating guy, actually. I'll touch on that as well. But and as regards hooks, I can't see where that's coming from at all. Especially when I say antics.
Do you know what? I'm talking about the band overall. And also, like, I'll talk about this album, this particular album, a bit later. But I think overall the band put me off because they aren't anything in particular that I want, and just as a genre, that's a problem for me. Like indie rock, just, I mean, the stalwarts of the genre, that, you know, like the classic albums, I just, it's something in me, they just fail to pick me up on. And yeah, like,
I'm not somebody that was, I was surprised that I got into Interpol, because certainly at the time I was listening to a lot of like Constellation stuff, I was listening to a lot of really heavy stuff, I was really into Dillinger Escape Plan, and then this band came out that I just couldn't shake the fact that fuck, I love these songs, and yet they're being delivered in a really innovative way that is acceptable to my kind of non-mainstream sensibilities. Mm-hmm. And that's why I was so impressed with Interpol at the time. I was like, it's nice to have something I can listen to that's a bit romantic and a bit tuneful and a bit sort of heart, a bit kind of melancholy, yet doesn't, you know, doesn't have that kind of cloy, sickly kind of effect of things like, I don't know, any number, like Death Cab for Cutie, for example, which is brilliant songs delivered so blandly, and like most of the emo stuff that I mean, certainly stuff like AFI, which is just so dull the way it's written and delivered. Like, some of the melodies are nice, but there's no inspiration at all about the way that the songs are arranged. And I think this was a band that took some of the elements of post-punk and a lot of the elements of goth that bands like AFI had incorporated, but just did something just way more adventurous with it. And there was no guarantee it was going to work. This wasn't a band that was like handpicked to work. They had a bassist who wasn't a bassist. They had a guitarist singer who'd started out into hip hop. They had just no real designs on the big time. Yet what they were doing got them there, which is kind of cool.
It's really interesting how we can hear completely fucking different things. Like, absolutely. But it comes back to the thing I think we've discussed before, particularly you've picked up on it, is when you're talking about records that maybe were quite influential at the time, but there's been a slew of absolute fucking garbage since this band came out that sounds a lot like it, that I just can't put away.
Yeah, but and even at the same time, this band ripped off a lot of stuff very blatantly.
Which is stuff that I don't like anyway.
Yeah, I mean,
so
they obviously loved Joy Division. There is clearly no way to get away from that at all.
Fucking hate Joy Division.
But they
so much.
Never, ever, ever pretended they didn't. But what they did do was take Joy Division in a much more rock direction and a much more kind of post-punk direction, and it was just something a bit more.
But unusual. What Mark's saying, I think we'll go back to like the influences in a minute, but what Mark says, like, there's a couple of tracks, and then on this particularly, because it's like their earlier stuff, that then I feel kind of been tarnished by the landfill indie that came over the next 5-10 years. And I recognize that, like, there's a couple of songs on this record that I'm like, oh, do you know what, it's basically just an update of sort of Smiths but more miserable, and I can kind of get behind that. But what has then happened is then bands like fucking Kaiser Chiefs and all these bands have then come along and then regurgitated it. And I've heard it so much over the last 15 years that I just can't deal with it. And then when you hear it on this record, you're like, I understand that they didn't make this shit, but it's been made shit.
You're jaded.
Since. And I'm truly jaded by that.
So the thing, a really key thing about Interpol is the fact that unlike the bands that were picking up on what they were doing, I think, because they're clearly an inspiration. I mean, for example, bands like Deftones, like Chino Moreno thinks this album is an absolute masterpiece. It was a band that these people who'd grown up on bands like the Smiths were really, really keen on, because they were clearly taking those inspirations and doing something very heartfelt about it. Even the Killers, when they do that cover, there's a little kind of like spoken word bit before it where he's talking about, yeah, there was all these good bands coming out, but few bands had this sheer enigmatic class of this New York quartet that nobody really knew what the fuck they were all about. And I think a big part of Interpol's mystique was its style, its approach, its aesthetic, the red and the black, the shades, the noirish thing.
They came out, they were cool compared to what had gone before. And that's entirely, I think that's maybe what got them much bigger than they, not deserved, but like this whole post-punk revival and the garage rock revival that came out, you know, post 2001, 2002, that was basically like a war against the new metal and the hip-hop and the R&B that had been dominating the charts for the last 5 years. And people were like, oh, just some lads with guitars. And like, thank fuck they don't have, you know, red baseball caps on and stuff like that. So yeah, they're just so much cooler. You know, like these guys and then the Strokes and then Franz Ferdinand, they're all coming out at different bits. But like, people were just really glad that they didn't have some sort of gimmick. Their gimmick was the fact they were stripped back and they were cool. And I think that gave them extra credibility.
Well, I think Interpol did have a gimmick. I think they clearly, when they landed, they were like...
Yeah, but they weren't wearing boiler suits.
No, but they were wearing suits and shades indoors, and they very, very rigidly stuck to that kind of wardrobe and that kind of like noirish, gothy aesthetic. Carlos Dengler, Carlos D, as he was known especially, went for almost a sort of like misfitsy kind of like hairdo at times, with a very heavily gelled long fringe and the really intense sort of red and black contrast in his outfits. I think that was a masterstroke in their part. It also really fitted with the whole New York chic thing. They were coming from New York. There was nods to bands like, I mean, they're basically like a mixture of Kraftwerk and Television. That's what their look is. It's maybe taken on board things like the Small Faces from the 60s, who were like one of the kind of first moddy style bands as well. But I think Interpol, whether or not they meant it, that was really key to them getting people's attention. But I don't think for a second they would have held that attention if their music wasn't so interesting. And in particular, if this album hadn't been such a journey, because it's easy to have one or two good songs. The Kaiser, Maximal Park's maybe a good example. Maximal Park had one or two actually quite good songs. But I'll be fucked if I'm going to listen to a full Maximum Park album. And I've tried, and it's just not happening, because there is no real sense of investment or through narrative to that band. Whereas when you listen to this album takes massive chances. By the third track, they're drifting away already into weird, dreamy, shoegazy stuff. It was a big gamble, this band, and it felt very organic. It didn't feel like they had any real expectation it was going to take off the way it did. And yeah, it did. So yeah, I mean, I'll backtrack very slightly, right? So the band themselves are from New York. They were actually started, I think most people associate Paul Banks, the frontman, with Interpol. And it was actually Daniel Kessler, the sort of kind of quiet spoken guitarist, rhythm. I don't know how you would divide the guitar duties in Interpol, because they do bits and bobs at each, but Daniel Kessler, who's the guitarist now, had started the band originally with a guy called, I think it's Greg Drudy. Yeah, Greg Drudy. And they had approached Carlos at New York University, where they were studying philosophy, which is kind of, you know, fitting with the sort of pretentious, art schooly, high-end vibe of the band. And they openly said they approached Carlos because of his style. They were like, there's this guy walking about looking like really cool and gothy and alternative, and they said, do you want to play in a band? He was like, he was a guitarist, he's a total shredder, Carlos Dengler. And he was like, well, do we want you to play the bass? He was like, I'll give it a shot. And he just took to it. And it was sometime later that Paul Banks got involved. I believe Daniel had actually originally met Paul Banks on some kind of exchange to Paris, and Paul had like refused because he was so into hip hop at the time, but then subsequently came back to New York. I believe he sat in on a practice. Long story short, he joined, and supposedly because of the crappy PA they had in the practice room, that's where he's really strong baritone approach developed to his vocals, because he was like, just couldn't get the amp, couldn't get the PA loud enough, and so he was just a lot of time forcing it, this really strong projected baritone. But yeah, so they were like a post-punk indie gothy kind of new wave band. As I said, for me aesthetically, huge swathes of Kraftwerk, big bits of Television, especially in the way the guitars kind of fragment and break up and create the illusion of bigger chords without them actually having to spell it out for you. Drudy left, they did a couple of EPs. Their first ever release actually was on Chemical Underground, the Scottish label.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so they were still very, very early in their career at the time. I think the EP is called Fucked ID Number 3, so FUKDID #3. Came out in December of 2000. It was only 1,000 copies. It had PDA on it, which went on to be a really big song for them. It was on their first four releases. A track called Precipitate, Roland, which is also on this album, and Five, which I believe had like a working title of Get the Girls. And their first ever show outside of the USA was at King Tut's.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it was only their second ever show outside of New York. They did a whole load of shows inside New York. They played once in Austin, then they went to Glasgow. And they played King Tut's three times in the next 2 years. And then suddenly they were playing the Barrowlands. And it was like, wow, this band is really taking off here. I remember when they were here, I remember them being talked about. And then like 2 years later, I'm like, fuck man, I really wish I'd paid attention to that. But yeah, a couple of tracks from that came back out in a thing called the Precipitate EP. Which they released themselves in the States, given that it was such a small release over here. There was a track in that called Song 7 and a track called A Time to Be So Small, which appeared on Antics as well. So at some point in those two EPs, I can't remember exactly when, but Drudy left and they'd played the demos to a guy called Sam Fogarino. I think Sam Fogarino had heard them initially, wasn't too taken, but then really liked where they were going with the music and joined. Sam Fogarino's a tremendous pop drummer.
He's a very good drummer.
His drum lines are so interesting. Mm-hmm. He does a lot of snare stuff, which is sometimes a bit incongruous, but works fucking brilliantly. But yeah, they did those EPs. Then they finally did an Interpol EP, which came out with Matador, and that was the start of the relationship with Matador, which is the label through which most of their materials emerged. But yeah, and then Turn On The Bright Lights came out. They played King Tut's the day this was released. The band's kind of history with Glasgow and Scotland, certainly via chemical, was very intertwined. And it's kind of interesting that, because I think at first I assumed there was some kind of Scottish connection. I think Paul and Daniel are actually both English, but they relocated to America really, really early. And then they released a thing called the Black EP. Two versions of that kicking about. One of them is a kind of six tracks, kind of abbreviated version of this live session they did in French radio, and then they also did a version which is, or there's at least an unofficial version which is like the full set from the French radio show, and it's decent. It's got a couple of tracks on it that are sort of like less well known. In 2004, they followed up Turn On The Bright Lights with Antics. But hey, who's on trial? Antics is a fucking great album. I think when I went back to see this, I didn't realise there was such a consensus about Turn On The Bright Lights as being their best album. Because certainly anecdotally, amongst my friends that are fans of the band, I think Antics is held in at least the same high regard.
It's certainly sold more, and it's
a lot more.
It's got bigger songs on it.
Way bigger singles in it. Yeah, it was like number 15 in the US. It was 21 over here.
Like I remember when I used to DJ the indie club at uni, Evil was the track from Interpol that I had.
There's a bunch. There's Evil, but there's also Slow Hands. Mm-hmm. There's a track, Khmer. It's way too late to be this locked inside ourselves. The trouble is, like, there's some really, really strong singles in that.
They're all top 40 hits in the UK.
And I think it was Drowned In Sound's best album of the year. It was in a lot of polls in 2004, actually. It's a lot cheerier and a lot poppier, which I think explains that accessibility, made it easier to DJ, like you said. Although, as I mentioned earlier, you could already hear the bass getting slightly lowered in the mix. And I think for people that were so enamoured with Carlos D's work, that was a little bit of a concern early on. You see that in some of the reviews. They're like, it's great, but we'd love to have heard more of Carlos, as we did previously. Even the opening track in that album, Next Exit, echoes that sort of thing of Untitled from this one. Which is this very dreamy, trippy, gradual, patient introduction. And I think that shows a maturity and a contributed to their sense of cool. This wasn't a band that started with a banger. This was a band that started on their own terms, both times. And there's also some great album tracks in that. Not Even Jail, Public Pervert. And Length of Love has a fucking tremendous bass line in it. That is a really, really strong album. I would have, if I'd thought for a minute that it was not quite as well reviewed as I assumed it was, then I may have considered that instead of this. But it's very hard to fit anything in between them, even though they're quite different. That was followed by Our Love to Admire, which was released in Capitol. They were on Capitol just for one. Our Love to Admire, by this point, they were making like really big waves. This went to number one in Mexico. And I think, Mark, you mentioned the Smiths. Interpol have a massive following in Mexico. They actually released their most recent album using a kind of short notice surprise gig in Mexico City. And it kind of reflects that weird Latin love of the Smiths. I don't know if you know about this, but in Los Angeles, for example, like, there's so many kids are absolutely obsessed with
this. Do you know what's interesting is I was just seeing on Instagram my pal Johnny, plays bass in the Twilight Sad, is currently, they're over in Mexico City right now, supporting The Cure in a huge fucking stadium. And like a lot of people like the Twilight Sad in Mexico, a lot of people love The Cure in Mexico. A lot of people love this sort of music in Mexico.
Yeah, they love that gothy post-punk stuff. Yeah. They absolutely fucking love it. That kind of melancholy, very almost melodramatic pop, indie pop. You know, the melodrama seems to really go over well. And I think that's something the Smiths and Morrissey were well known for.
Yeah.
And it's something that there's definitely huge, huge, huge chunks of it mixed in with Interpol. Our Love to Admire had a little bit more keys in it, but again, the bass was a wee bit lower. It's a really, really, really good selection of songs on it. Pioneer to the Falls is a terrific opener. No Eye and Threesome and the Heimlich Manoeuvre are brilliant singles, like really catchy singles. And then some of the album tracks like The Scale, Mammoth, Who Do You Think You, I think it's Who Do You Think or Who Do You Think You Are, whatever, they're really strong. And The Lighthouse, the final track in it, is just a really beautiful closer. The only thing is, there's a couple of weaker tunes in it. There's a song that's quite well known by them called Rest My Chemistry, which I never understood why it was so popular. It seems a bit banal to me, and a track called All Fired Up, albeit that track ends fucking brilliantly, but the verse chorus is a little bit insufferable. But they were still on track at this point. The albums were consistently changing, maybe becoming slightly poppier, but I don't think anybody was disappointed other than the occasional gripe about Carlos getting lower in the mix. And I don't know what happened in 2010, but they brought out a self-titled album called Interpol, and something was drastically different in the band. Now, Carlos actually left the band before this album was released. Well, he said that everything started to get so routine. The touring, the expectations, the obligation to do this, the obligation to do that. He said that it just became very stifling. I don't really know what they were doing with this record. It's ambitious. It's very atmospheric. It uses a lot of repetition, but sometimes all the worst things come out. Like, the ambition isn't realised, the repetition gets quite dull, the atmospherics kind of override the songs, or at least the songs are neglected for the sake of the atmospherics. It's really, really disappointing, to be honest. The album features Azealia Banks as well, which is just a sign for me, a bad sign that this is a band that's starting to believe its own hype a wee bit, getting people like that in, because that just isn't something that seems in keeping with the band of the first album, Turn On The Bright Lights. The reviews on this album are very lukewarm, albeit inexplicably, when you look at Metacritic, it still gets a bizarrely high rating. I think it's mostly seen as a bit of a cliff amongst people that are really into them, albeit I'm sure super fans find a way to love it. There's a track on it called Lights that I think is one of their best tracks. Teach me to grieve and conspire with my age. All that I can see. But it's very much meagre pickings. Aside from that, and it was pretty gutting. It was actually pretty gutting, and weirdly left me a little bit scunnered with them. And because they leave such long spells of time between their albums, by the time El Pintor, the fifth album, came out, I wasn't really paying much attention to them, I'll be honest. I was a little bit put off by the sort of pedestrian nature of them by that point. This was seen by a lot of folk as a bit of a return to form. El Pintor, by the way, is an anagram of Interpol, and it also means the painter. So that works out nicely for them. It's the first album they did without Carlos. They'd actually briefly had Dave Pajo, who was in Slint, on bass for them. But then Paul Banks just moved over to bass permanently. There's guest appearances in this one again. I think one of the guys from Bon Iver's on it. And again, that just doesn't feel like Interpol to me, certainly not the Interpol of the first couple of records. There's five singles on it. And I really don't think there's five particularly good songs on it. It still gets a better rating on Metacritic than Our Love to Admire, which is nonsense. There's a, weirdly enough, The Skinny is an arts paper based in Scotland, and I noticed that one of the standout quotes that I could find from reading reviews of this album was a guy called Gary Cale. So Gary, if you listen to this, I'm going to take issue with you, mate. He called this arguably their strongest since their debut. What the fuck are you smoking, Gary?
Yeah, that's definitely not true.
it's fucking nonsense. Yeah. But yeah.
I mean, sometimes an album comes along by a band that you've been hoping are good, so you just pretend it's good.
Yeah.
Like, oh, do you know? Ah, no, I'm just going to give it a pass.
It's fucking wishful thinking in the extreme. I think also tellingly, the bass is back up in the mix, but now Paul's playing it. And it's like, well, I wonder if Paul had a lot to say at some of the mixes. But yeah, I mean, there's the first track on it, actually, All the Rage Back Home. Maybe that's all Gary listened to. Because it is a really strong track. It's really direct. It's much more post-punky and driving. It really comes across. The second track and the third track, My Desire and Anywhere, are fine. But then after that, it's just a mulch of like totally average stuff. Stuff that on any of the earlier records would have been a bit of a skipper. And as much as I want to try and find positives in it, there just isn't a lot. I mean, there's a track on it called Ancient Ways that is fucking bad. I mean, it's just a mess. Sonically, structurally, it's just a fucking bad song. The album's kind of mundane, it's a bit uninspired, and it kind of sounds, as you were saying, Dave, about the slew of bands that came after them, it sounds like an average band trying to rip off Interpol, which, to be honest, maybe it actually is by this point. I'm not really sure.
You're talking about the editors, yeah?
Well, see, they're another perfect example of a band that saw this, saw the gothy aesthetic, saw the baritone.
Well, funnily enough, the editors were formed in 2002. And I'm just wondering if they literally heard that album and went, let's just be exactly that band.
Well, funny thing as well, I've heard editors' demos prior to their album sessions, and they sound a bit more like the Coral. So there's a lot of production involved in that band as well. Their most recent album, Marauder, 2018. I can't shake the feeling that it's maybe a band circling the drain at this point. The only thing is, the first track in this, If You Really Love Nothing, really deserves to be mentioned, because it's absolutely fucking amazing for the verse. And then the chorus arrives and it interrupts the verse. Then the chorus fucks off again and then it's amazing again. It's like, if you were like in a bedroom like making out with somebody and then
fire alarm,
your mate just keeps coming and going, oh, I'm sorry, I've left my left my tobacco, sorry, and he's not a bad guy, but you're like, fuck off. And then 2 minutes later he fucking comes in again, he's like, guys, I'm really sorry, but I've got to get my phone charged, and you're like, fuck it. It just, the chorus keeps arriving and derailing what's actually a fucking brilliant song. And it's the first time they've reached that level of brilliance in a decade easily, and yet they make this really bad decision with the songwriting by keeping it in, and then the end of the track is just overlong, and not in a good way, because some of the tracks that Interpol do are quite long and quite indulgent at the end, like PDA, but it's usually in a very considered fashion. This just rumbles on, and it's such a shame, because the verses in this show that they're still a band with great potential moments. The second track, The Rover, is not bad. It's a bit more old school, but it kind of deteriorates again. It's that kind of sour chord thing. And there's a lot of chat that Paul Banks over the years has blown his voice now. I mean, his voice is, singing in baritone is actually quite taxing on your voice.
Totally is.
And Paul Banks is a chain smoker. I mean, it's literally part of almost every video they do is Paul Banks smoking or smoke blowing across the camera. It's a big part of their aesthetic. A lot of the kind of vloggers talk about it, even like super fans are like, you know, I hate to say this, but I think Paul's done it. I think his voice is just gone, and they're now trying to compensate by way, way overusing processing on the vocals, using a lot of reverb and a lot of delay, so it becomes really washy. Mm. It can become really hard to distinguish between the vocals and the guitars and the keys. It can get dead messy. There's a track called Stay in Touch in this, which I think is just fucking plain awful. And the track number seven, Mountain Child, sounds like Interpol are trying to do a killer song, mm-hmm. which is just, well, I guess, ironic, but fucking absolutely not. Not a good turn of events, and the album ends up being like a real slog. As I say about circling the drain, I don't want to think that, because there's always the potential that a band can turn it around, but the returns are getting more and more meagre mm-hmm. as it goes on. And I think they've never been the same. There's no point denying it, they've never been the same since Carlos left. There's absolutely no way to get away from that. Yeah. The guy is fucking incredibly gifted musician, and man, they've really, really struggled, I think, to maintain the standards without them. Yeah, and so that just kind of leaves Turn on the Bright Lights, the album I chose. So considering all of that, and considering how good I think albums 2 and 3 are, it wasn't like a dead easy choice, mm-hmm. but Our Love to Admire sold big, certainly by indie rock standards, and Antics, with the big singles, was much more high profile.
Yeah.
And did chart a lot higher generally. As I said, Turn on the Bright Lights didn't break the top 100. And that's not great. We've covered a lot of albums that are, we would maybe say, are less critically revered, that have been far, far higher chart-wise, albums that have got to like the 40s and stuff. So I was surprised, actually. I thought it would have got slightly higher than that, because I do remember a lot of people talking about it, but it seems to have been a slow burner. It seems to be one that people...
Yeah, debut album as well, you know, a first record is the thing that builds the hype.
Yeah, but I mean, like, The Killers, was their first one, Hot Fuss?
Hot Fuss.
Yeah, I mean, that was fucking massive.
Yeah, but yeah. It had about 14 singles on it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so Turn on the Bright Lights, I just, for my money, I don't know of many better first albums by a band, in my opinion. I think, I think certainly in indie rock especially, I mean, The ones of the time, the Arcade Fire and the Strokes are good contenders, the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, all had great first albums. For me, this is easily up there with any of those. It's quite an unfussy album, it's quite unplanned, it's inconsistent, but inconsistent in a way that shows that there was no big sort of record label involvement in its arrangement. It's quite indulgent. Some of the tunes have 4 minutes of fucking instrumentation at the end that they would never have got away with on their later albums, when there was so much more expectation for radio play. But this album is unrefined in a way that I think really complements the sensibilities of the guys making it. As I said, the aesthetics are brilliant. Really, like, the cover, that they just looked like they just didn't give a fuck about the cover. The weird red curtain on a black background at an odd angle, and that kind of colour scheme is just echoed all the way through their career. Yeah, it feels like a whole work. It feels like a band that's been gestating, because, I mean, it was like 5 years at this point, more than 5 years actually at this point, that this band had been slowly piecing together this arsenal of stuff. And as I said, the song PDA had been on all their releases, including the demos. So they'd workshopped this music for quite some time. And I think it really shows, in a way that some of the later stuff clearly shows it hasn't been. Mm-hmm. Untitled, the opening tune, again, super nonchalant title, so vague, so in keeping with this kind of like casual smoking fucking New York cool hipster vibe of the band. It's such a confident way to start your debut album. Really sort of like ketamine shoegaze, kind of dreamy sort of fugue state kind of music. I fucking love it.
Yeah, like I do like this track. I like, it is understated, and I can see the Twilight Sad got a lot from this band.
Definitely.
But do you know, funnily enough, I think like what this band are to the Twilight Sad are also what like the National are to Frightened Rabbit, i.e. they were very influential, but I think the Twilight Sad and Frightened Rabbit then came along and improved it by adding a whole lot of personality, which I think lacks here, certainly in the National. And
I mean, I say I 100% agree with the National. I think, again, people will be fucking tearing their hair out saying that Interpol don't have personality. I think, like, the strength of the aesthetic and the vibe of the band is so strong. I mean, you could draw Interpol for a challenge and people would guess what it was, but could you draw the National and have people guess, oh, that's the National you're drawing? Could you? You certainly couldn't draw the Twilight Sad.
Yeah, but being cool isn't personality. Being cool is a much more visual thing, a much more shallow thing. Like, a personality is like a deep down heart.
I mean maybe you're, I don't know if there's a lot of objectivity in that, man, because we know the Twilight Sad.
Of course, I love
the Twilight Sad, but I don't think objectively it's a band with a strong personality. It's artwork's stronger.
I think James's delivery is way more personal and emotional and driven than anything Interpol have ever done.
I don't agree with that, but I guess we'll just have to disagree on that.
And I think you're both wrong, so
great.
Obstacle number one. This is the track that first got me into Interpol. I just caught the video by accident. I think it was maybe 100 minutes, something like that I was watching. And the video is just so fucking perfectly judged, again, for the aesthetic of the band. I think it looks like an airport departures lounge or something, but it's deserted, and it's the band kind of badly lit, wearing shades, smoking, playing these songs, just looking fucking cool as shit. There is a quite sort of superficial appeal to the sort of shirts and ties, suit jackets, that kind of thing, but fuck, man, it really worked. And the instantaneous nature of the song follows so well from Untitled as well, because you're not really sure where this album's going. It's a very slow start. But this comes in very, very, very directly with that kind of like sporadic staccato guitar line, and the drums coming in after that, that really sets it off. It immediately shows that this is a band that's going to be defined by this and super inventiveness with their guitar interplay as well, because straight away you've got this kind of stereo mirroring of the two guitar lines, one kind of call and response to the two different guitar parts, which kind of start to spiral around each other as the chords get more complicated.
I wish I was as high as you are right now, man, because this is not at all, right. Not even at all, I mean, what I can hear. The actual, not even remotely what I can hear.
From a songwriting perspective, the structure of this song is very unusual. If you compare it to your kind of usual verse, chorus, verse, or even like your kind of Idlewild verse, pre-chorus, chorus, it's got way more bits. If you were to sit and learn this, you'd be like, oh fuck, I forgot this bit. This is a song that has been built up incrementally by a band rehearsing it for a long fucking time, because it does not follow like a simple template. The baritone in it is very strong, and I think that appealed to people right out the gate. And I think one of the things about Interpol, when you combine the aesthetic, the kind of romance, the kind of overwrought romance of it, that Smithsy melodrama, as well as the kind of cool looks and the anti-macho approach. Also, some of the lyrics, I mean, we never mentioned in Untitled, lines like, I'll surprise you sometime, I'll come around when you're down, have this kind of like sort of post-Generation X kind of slacker. It's a very intangible thing, but a romanticism, a kind of sloppy romanticism. I also think the snare drum breakdown at the end of the song is a very unusual decision, but a very, very cool decision before it goes into that outro.
I like the drums on that song a lot, and they do kind of interesting things with the guitars, but to me it just sounds like struggling to get drunk in the QMU during the worst indie night in the world. Right. But there's still stuff. The thing is, like, I didn't say anything about the first song either, but there's a lot of shit I like about the song. Like, the reverb and guitars are lovely, right? Really, really nice. The bass tone is consistently awesome throughout this entire record.
Yeah, and this is not a big budget recording.
Yeah. I often like how Lowe's voice is in the mix as well, not because I don't like his voice, but I hate his voice, but that's not why I like it. I like it because it gives it a really nice aesthetic appeal. Mm. Do you know what I mean? There's a lot of interesting touches that I enjoy about the music, like from a I guess, a critical point of view, like great decision production wise.
Yeah, well, know, remember I was saying about their PA being really quiet in the practice room. The album reflects that. The album, like the voice is sunk into the music because the album was trying to capture what they heard in their music, and they'd become, given that they came from nowhere and they were in some cases a band of not actually a band of guys that were on instruments that did not come naturally to them. Mm-hmm. They were like, let's just replicate what we're making in that practice room. So production decisions like that are in keeping with the authenticity of the music they were making. NYC is a good example of that, because that's another one where everything's really dreamy and really sunk into the mix. It's a really unexpected downbeat turn so early in an album. Like you've started quiet, but then you've got it going, and I think people could sort of be like, oh, they've done a fake out, right, okay, now it's going to get going, but then they kind of slink it back down again. Decisions like that also still appeal to that sense of like a band that are cool enough and confident enough, even at this really early stage in their career, to take chances like that. It is a chance when you're sequencing an album, especially one that's got kind of bangers later on, well, bangers inverted commas, but faster tracks later on, to do this so early. The drum line in this, I think, is fucking genius, because it's such a simple song and it could have been really boring, but he's offset the snare in such a clever way,
yeah,
all the way through the lines. I don't think you necessarily notice it until you actually specifically listen to Mike. That's such a fucking clever drumline just to make this unconventional, because it could have been a very dreary conventional tune. With that one thing changed, just a 4-4 would have made this totally unremarkable, I think.
It makes the empty space of the song a bit more dynamic, which I quite like.
It does. It gives it an angle. It makes it more angular in a weird, kind of fairly gentle way.
Dreadful lyrics, though.
I actually disagree, because I think I'm sick of spending these lonely nights training myself not to care.
The subways are porn on the pavements of the RMS. Yeah. It's supposed to support me for a long time. Somehow I'm not impressed. Okay, cool. Nice one, Paul.
Subway is a porno is a lyric that just is so fucking Interpol as well, though. It's that thing where you do something that's deliberately slightly ridiculous, and they've done this on albums all the way through, where they've thrown in phrases that are there to sort of contribute to that aesthetic of kind of dumb but cool. It's like almost like a Ramonesy reference. These kind of like slightly goofy lyrical turns, but in a cool fucking New York sort of way. It's a very hard thing to really sum up without fucking spending another hour trying to analyse, you know, the linguistics of it. But there is a deliberacy in that I think is overlooked. It is a daft lyric, but it's a daft lyric that was left in there on purpose and weirdly ended up being a hook, which is sort of a masterstroke, you know? I think in this song as well, again, on the drum side of things, the really sparse but clever use of the bell on the ride, yeah, is a very nice touch. And the second vocal that comes in, which I think is Daniel, is just this sort of like nursery rhyme echo in the background that just builds it up without them lashing on loads of layers of guitar and distortion. It builds it up subtly but really noticeably. And then it brings on to PDA, and PDA, for anyone that's into Interpol, is a fucking massive tune. It's a massive, massive tune. It's also a game changer in terms of arrangement. I think, you know, a lot of people cite the Pixies as being that kind of like loud, quiet, which obviously Nirvana then took. But PDA and the way that they structured this tune, I think it's underestimated how many bands this has influenced. And obviously Interpol didn't invent this, but they certainly popularized it for a new generation of indie songwriters, having this like verse chorus song, which is good in its own right. It's a really great song. It's very direct, it's very minor, it's kind of driving, it's a nice car song, and the bass line in it is that dead serpentine sort of approach to bass playing up and down the neck that Carlos has really complements the tune. But where it comes into its own is the outro. The fucking outro in this song is majestic. It's like about, it's about a minute 50, nearly 2 minutes of outro, which just very, very, it drops out, gradually builds up, and then there's just this beautiful moment where the bass line drops into the low register for two notes, and then the drums crash in behind it. And then it takes you on this beautiful, just sort of rolling, melodic, intertwining guitar outro with a keyboard over the top of it, and then the vocals become quite sort of ghostly and just kind of like gently howled with loads of reverb. It's fucking just such a fucking great bit of music in the outro to PDA, and I'm not surprised it was on all their early releases, and it is just iconic in terms of the band's reputation. I don't think they would have been the band they are without that song, and without that song ending the way it ends. It's fucking massive. Now, you were talking about Smiths. Say Hello to the Angels is a Smiths song. It's just...
Yeah, and that annoyed me as a result of that. Yeah.
I mean...
This is one of the ones that I was talking about where it just totally reminds me of the shit that came after it. And it reminds me of, you know, like Futureheads and Maximo Park and Editors and all that jangly enemy pish that we had to put up with for a decade.
And it's not a style of song that they did much of afterwards, albeit I do rate this song because they break it down in a way that none of those bands would have. Yeah, the verse, chorus, that kind of spanky Smiths thing and the kind of Morrissey-esque approach to the vocals is, yeah, that's been done, and it's been done since, and it is a little bit grating, especially in the years since. But the way they disassemble this song, the way the drums break down, the way the guitars break down, and they start to syncopate and they start to call and response... in what's almost like quite a post-hardcore-y kind of jawboxy style. It's not in any way emo or hardcore, but the...
No, but the ingredients are.
Yeah, the separation of ingredients and even just the instinct that we can't let this song just finish verse, chorus, end because it's going to be nothing remarkable. We have to do something special. Take a chance. These people might hate it. There's probably kids out there that love the Smiths that hate the ending of this song. But luckily, I come from the other side, which is I love Fugazi, and I love the ending of this song because it has that clever innovation, especially of like later Fugazi, like Argument era Fugazi, where things are sort of bouncing off each other. And I think it's fucking great.
It's interesting you say that because like you're thinking of the Smiths there just in your like this charming man, you know, their hits. But there's parts of the Smiths off that first record and stuff like that that do just have like an instrumental outro and like mad weird things that happen that Morrissey isn't near for like 2 minutes.
Yeah, but I mean, so this like, is like chopped mutes and stuff. This is not, you're right. They're absolutely, you're right. I'm sort of not giving them credit for some of the music they did, but at the same time, the chopped mutes approach, chopped mutes on the guitar, bouncing off the drums is much more of a kind of Fugazi-ish technique than it is one of the kind of jangly kind of English bands of that era. Hands Away, which is like a super gothy, very synthy, trippy song. Pacer. It's one that took a while to get because so many other tracks are much more immediate, but I have to say it's one that fucking really works in the context of it. It's dead haunting and it really broadens the palette of the record overall. That really big, grandiose, slightly pompous thing. It's a song that it's quite OTT and I really dig that about it. Obstacle number two, again, even with the track namings, just dead fucking nonchalant. Like, it's a band that were like, I'm not going to waste too much time coming up with these things. Obstacle disco number two, it starts in a really normal fashion, but it kind of diverts in some really odd ways during the song itself. There's a couple of like quite aggressive bits at, I think it's about a minute 30 and about 2 minutes 30. But it just gets a bit harder in a way that it didn't seem like the song was actually going to go. The eighth track, Stella Was a Diver and She Was Always Down. Again, playing on the very sort of uber cool, has that sort of weird accent-y spoken introduction to the song. Has that tradition that they have now of like naming random women in the lyrics, you know, like names that are sort of context-free women's names that give it this sort of sense of having some sort of personal poignancy. There's some really interesting touches in the song. It's not one of my favourites in the record. I think it's a good song, and I know that from friends that like the band, it's one of their favourites. Some of the drum roll stuff is excellent. Again, just underlining how innovative a drummer Sam Fogarino is, especially within the confines of pop music. I think there's a couple of wee bass breaks just before choruses that just do not sound like a guy who was raised on heavy metal. And that's to his credit that this guy grew up listening to all these fucking ripping bands, hair metal bands, and yet has these massive disco instincts when he's doing these.
I think on this track, like, I think the songs on this album live or die by the strength of their vocal hook and melody for me. Like, overall, you've got great stuff going on underneath, but like, it's either going to be a boring track or it's going to be a good track if it's got a good hook, or if it's not got an annoying hook. And this is one of the ones that just kind of grated with me.
I've got the same vocal melody, basically the verse and the chorus, like, really.
So, like, actually would concede that the phrase Stella on this, when he's singing the name, is grating. I think it's one of the only points in this album where his voice does grate on me, and obviously because I love the album so much, it's something that I learned to kind of absorb, you know, to take the hit. I think it's like a bit of eccentricity in their part. Musically speaking, it's not my favourite moment, but I certainly, in terms of the context, it's still a good song. But I would concede that, yeah, he really, really leans in to the vocal in this one, arguably too much. The song ends in a really unusual way, though, because it ends in this like really upbeat, sort of spanky outro that I didn't see coming.
It's
much more optimistic bit of music. And it goes straight into track 9, Roland, which is actually quite an old song for the band, but a fucking belter. This is them at their most post-punk. Really fast, really direct for an indie band. The come on whispers, there's a couple of wee whispers through it that just add like a nice wee kind of element of cool. I think tonally, it's a fucking brilliant song. The tones of the guitar and the bass in this are tremendous. And there's an ending that kicks in from about 3 minutes onwards, this kind of big guitar refrain. Really, the guitar pushes up, one of the guitars really pushes to the front with a lot of reverb on it, and it's a big, big moment for them.
See, this is a song, I did like this song.
Same.
But like, this is one that I can't work out Interpol, because I can't work out if I've listened to this album before, and I can't work out if I've seen them live before. I genuinely don't know if I've seen them live before. But listening to Roland, I was like, oh, I think I kind of remember this. This is like a standout track to me. I kind of know this, but I'm like, but I don't think I've really listened to this album before, and I'm not sure if I've ever seen them before. So I don't know if it's just because they're taking things that I've heard before, or they're, you know, bands have then taken stuff from them. I mean, this is a standout track to me on the record, but it just also reinforced the fact that I truly don't know where I stand with them, because they're so, I don't know, they float in this grey, cool cloud. that I've never been in before.
Red and black.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a testament to the diversity of this record, that this track's on it and NYC's on it. And also the last two tracks, The New and Leif Erikson, are further testimony to that end. Mm-hmm. The New starts and ends like two completely different songs. So quiet at the start with that little cute sweet bass line that comes in and the wee strums of the headstock. It's a really close, a really personal soft vocal, and there's a couple, like a nice kind of little chorus lift to something that's quite beautiful, but then it suddenly just changes and the track takes this really noisy minor atonal turn. They start bending the strings in and out of tune as the rest of the instruments are rumbling along. The bass in it is fucking almost funky at times, whilst the guitars are doing this really dissonant thing. And that track alone is like a microcosm of the completely polar opposites of this band. You know, the things they can do, not just in the space of this one album or their career, but in one song. You know, it's an indulgent track, but I think it's an indulgent track in a way that encourages other musicians who like it to take chances in their music, because I think it works. And the final track, Leif Erikson, by the way, the Norse explorer who was the first man to America, long, long, long before Christopher Columbus in the, nice. The 10th century.
I like that
also,
song.
Also invented the Sony Ericsson.
She says it helps with the light. It's got some fucking lovely lyrics in this song. It's a big, croony, emotive tune. Lyrics like it's like learning a new language. There are moments that Interpol fans, they get the gush. They close the eyes and they sing along with them live. It's just a really lush song. And I think the outro is just one final moment of gorgeousness. I just think it's a tremendous ending to the album. It's a tremendous cap on a very diverse, very uncontrived, spontaneous work that I think came from 5 years of these people just having no real plan, just getting in a room, picking up instruments they weren't even used to and seeing what came out. And then actually, as you said, with the approach to the production and stuff, replicating it authentically. And it just really struck a chord with people when it landed. I think what came after it was much more of an attempt of the band to try and be a bit more deliberate. And I think certainly for the first two albums after that, it really worked, but then went badly off track in recent years. But I just love how sincere this record is, and yet the fact that it was so accomplished. Because a lot of sincere attempts at albums are flawed because they're very naive, or they don't land, or they get something right but not the other thing right. For me, and for the many people I know that fucking really treasure this album, I think it just represents like indie music, especially at its most relevant and poignant.
So what's going on then?
Well, I hope so. I think it's an absolute classic. I really do.
Mark?
I actually felt it was quite insincere. I think they are unapproachable, completely unapproachable.
And have you met them?
Every capacity. Like, I wouldn't want to meet them because they just seem like dicks to me. They seem
man,
like,
have you ever seen Carlos being interviewed? He's a fucking gem.
I'm sure he is. They seem really elitist to me, and I don't like that.
Oh, they absolutely are. That's exactly the aesthetic they're going for.
I really hate that. I'm a Prince fan, so obviously elitism is definitely a thing, right? But
can I hit the Prince alarm?
You definitely should hit that shit. No, it's just the vocal. Vocals are a huge thing for me, as you know. Nah, not at all. Like,
I mean, it's Marmite. Some people fucking hate the baritone thing, but for me, a lot of people have tried it. Most of them fucked it. Interpol, especially on the first three records,
absolutely killed it. I love it.
Musically, I understand what it's doing. It sounds very nice a lot of the time. It sounds like, it sounds cracking. Pretty much the whole record sounds Chicks fucking cracking, man. But it's just, yeah, it just feels so empty to me.
I mean, it's cold wavy. There's no getting away from that. It's like, there's a long history of that kind of stuff in New York, and it definitely aesthetic as well borrows from that cold wave legacy. Absolutely. Mm. Yet the analog approach to their playing and recording, I think, more than compensates for that coldness. I think that's the thing. It's a nice balance. It's the reason that the video for Obstacle Number One was in an empty airport departure lounge. It's that emptiness, as you say. They do embrace that. I think it's very intrinsic to what they're trying to do.
It pushes me away too much. And then there's also the other layer of it, which I can't remove. And obviously I'm completely, it's got complete blinders on. It's like, it just sounds like so much dross that's come afterwards that I can't put myself in that moment. Like obviously we've all done that with records we've done here. Like, we just can't put ourselves in that moment. So no, I don't think this band needs discography.
Yeah, I'm with Mark in terms of it. It sounds really nice and it sounds great. And I was listening into the car on the way here, and I'm just like, you know, it's a nice kind of warm place to be when I'm concentrating on something else. But when I actually go to it, nothing captures me. It's like the good bits are when they like meander into this like post-punk, post-rock sort of thing. But then I'm like, I mean, we did fucking Cult of Luna last week, and like, they then take that and go beyond with, like, literally beyond with it, and just go so far and experiment. And that's where I personally want my music to go. Or when they've got, like, the hooks, which I really like. There's some really good bits. Like, I really love NYC, like, that hook. And then, I mean, I think Evil was, like, a great tune on the next album and stuff like that. But, I don't know, overall, this album kind of defines my relationship with indie rock or indie, in that it's, like, I've gone along parallel with it for like 15 years where all my friends listen to it and love it, and this is the sort of shit that they're into. And because I've worked at student radio and then put on gigs in Glasgow, I've ended up going to a lot of gigs like this, and I've been to festivals, and I've seen television do Marquee Moon, and I've been to see The Cure, and I've seen Echo and the Bunnymen and all that.
Oh yeah, they're one that we've not mentioned, and that's that. Yeah, Killing Moon, that kind of vibe is very much.
And I hear lots of these bands.
Well, we didn't mention Gang of Four, and Gang of Four is a big part.
I hear lots of these bands, and they're in playlists, and they're in the car, and I pick up bits of it, and some of it I really like. But then, no matter what, when I am on my own, I never fucking put it on. I'm going to be listening to Cult of Luna or Meshuggah or Venetian Snares or Bjork or Aphex Twin, because they go somewhere extra. They're not this like middle ground.
I don't want to just deride indie rock as a thing, though. It's something.
Oh, I do. I mean, you are, and that's fine. That you're not going to. And I am in the vast minority here. I sit in my office of a music promoter, you know, an indie music promoter, and we put on gigs like this constantly, and we listen to music like this constantly in the office. And all my friends listen to this, and you know, when we go to fucking clubs, it's, you know, what they're asking for, and blah blah blah. None of it. I've never ever got it. I've never picked up on it unless there's something fucking dramatic or weird or personal about it. And like, that happens occasionally. There's like an indie band that I really like, and I go, yeah, I fucking understand it. But this, I know that it's good at what it is, but it never ever ever captured me. And like, so much indie music just fails to, I just fail to get on board with it. Even though everybody else in the fucking world loves it. So, and then also, my final point, number 9, best album of the decade, E-Music. Number 7, best album of the decade, Beats Per Minute. Number 3, best album of the decade, Under the Radar. Number 20, best album of the decade, Pitchfork. Number 12, best album of the decade, Music, OMH. It's not an underrated album.
Well, I mean, but as you know, we've obviously had the same thing with the Downward Spiral. I think what I'm suggesting is that given what a huge impact this album had on indie rock. I mean, you guys are talking about the sheer volume of stuff that imitated it, including over here, that entire movement of Kaiser Chiefs, Maximal Park, Future Heads, Franz Ferdinand. Those guys all
lifted. Still going as well.
Heavily, heavily, heavily. This is
a two-door cinema club headlined and sold out two academies last night.
I know.
Or the last
two
weeks.
So, I mean, you're talking about a band. It's undeniable how big an influence this band had. As I said, even guys like Chino Moreno and stuff going out and doing interviews specifically about this album. You know, this is a hugely influential album that didn't even break the top 100. I know it's been critically revered since then, and I know that in some magazines at the time they acknowledged its importance as well. But what I'm saying is, over the piece, certainly commercially, it's completely underrepresented given its enormous legacy and given how it, not single-handedly, because it was part of a clutch of bands, but it definitely helped to revitalise an entire genre, which was basically dead in the water.
Well, we'll see what the audience say. Go and vote for this. I passionately, passionately, passionately do not care. And that is much like so much indie music. But yeah, fair play. I totally get it. I understand why you like it. I just don't give a fuck about it.
Fucking Nexus was easier.
I enjoyed the Nexus.
Will we do that?
Yeah, on you go, Chris.
This is the first time we're seeing Nexus tonight. Will it be the last? What do they have in store for us?
This is not good.
Why am I here?
You're in the Nexus.
This is the Nexus.
For you, this is what you want.
Oh, hey, man. So who chose it?
It was Corey Robinson, wasn't it?
Corey Robinson's anybody to try and say it?
Rabindranath Tagore.
There you go.
Is that the actual pronunciation of the second name?
I have no idea.
No, near that.
Thakur, he was born, but I'm not sure.
Fakur, I think, is like an Indian mystic.
Indian, so yeah.
Yeah.
So we should explain who he is. We should explain
who
he is. I
totally forgot for a second.
Yeah, sorry. And do you want to explain who he is?
Poet, playwright, polymath, basically. Artist, from India.
Gentleman.
Yeah.
Outspoken.
Very outspoken.
Opponent of nationalism and things like that.
Yeah, he actually seems like a really fucking interesting character.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Big pals with a lot of prominent people at the time, which will maybe pop up in some of these next night. Starting with Interpol, the drummer of Interpol, or the main drummer of Interpol, Sam Fogarino, says that one of the bands, and maybe the band, that switched them on to kind of alternative pop and indie rock and the potential for that was The Cars.
Great band. Well, do you know what? Some great songs, never listened to an album.
Yeah.
But some great fucking tunes.
Well, he was saying that he grew up obsessed with the first two LPs and then the third LP, whatever it's called, I don't know, really sealed the deal for him. But he said it was through The Cars that he got into stuff like Talking Heads and Devo, and that's all stuff with relevance to New York and CBGBs and all that kind of crew. So L.A. Easton was the lead guitarist for The Cars. By the way, considered amongst some sort of guitar aficionados as one of the most underrated guitarists, sort of pop rock guitarists of all time. Played some really, really recognisable and quite excellent solos in some of their stuff. Just What I Needed being a perfect example. Belter a tune. So L.A. Easton actually performed the song Run Rudolph Run alongside Mr. William Shatner.
Holy shit.
on the Christmas album from 2018, Shatner Claus.
Wow.
Which, by the way, that album also had Henry Rollins, Iggy Pop, Billy Gibbons, and all manner of other fucking people.
Of course it does. It's fucking William Shatner.
It's outstanding.
Brilliant.
Yeah, William Shatner's Christmas album from 2018. Give it a listen. In 1962, a film was released directed by Roger Corman called The Intruder. And in it, William Shatner played a guy called Adam Kramer. And basically, The Intruder was based on a 1959 book by Charles Beaumont. And that itself was a sort of fictionalised version of the events of 1956, around about the time of the US Supreme Court case, Brown versus the Board of Education, which was the case that sort of determined school segregation and prohibited it and ordered, it was Clinton High School in Tennessee, to desegregate. And there's all those famous pictures of, of black pupils being bussed in and all the shit that those people had to deal with.
Learned a lot about that at Memphis National Civil Rights Museum. It's really, really interesting.
Absolutely, really, really interesting. Anyway, so those protests, the protests against the desegregation, so the protests against the black students coming back, were actually spearheaded by a guy called John Casper. And John Casper was a member of the KKK. He was also a writer and an outspoken white supremacist speaker. He'd actually arrived in town in Clinton from New Jersey, where he was from, to try and just basically stir up shit and block the integration of these students. Casper, by the way, had a bookshop in Greenwich Village, and I tried to find a connection through New York. I could probably have got it, but I gave up because it was late. But the bookshop was called Make It New. So just KKK guy with a bookshop in Greenwich Village. There you go. Apparently that happens. He was also suspected of a school bombing in Nashville and also multiple synagogue bombings at the time, although they couldn't actually tie him to the crimes. But, you know, when they suspect
it's definitely in the MO,
yeah. Anyway, John Casper was an ardent devotee of Mr. Ezra Pound.
See, Ezra Pound's actually a fucking great poet, but massive anti-Semite.
Yeah, so some people say Ezra Pound's written some of the greatest poetry
of
all time.
I would agree with that.
However,
total cunt of a man.
So John Casper sent Ezra Pound 400 letters between 1950 and 1963 when Ezra Pound was in St. Elizabeth's Hospital, where he'd been sent on a treason charge. And actually, because of the association with John Casper, it delayed Ezra Pound's release. John Casper was campaigning for Ezra Pound's release, but because of Ezra Pound's close relationship to John Casper and Casper's well-known affiliation with the KKK and his history of like protesting against desegregation, Pound spent longer in the hospital than he actually had to. When Pound was released, by the way, he went straight back to Italy. I think it was like, is it 19... I can't even remember now, 58 maybe? The first thing he did when he got off the plane in Italy was shoot a fascist salute. There you go. But Ezra Pound, famous poet, lived in Italy, big fascist, huge fan of Mussolini, in one interview called Hitler a Saint, broadcast over 100 times on Italian radio, speaking out in very strong terms against the USA, but also especially against Jews. Fucking hated Jews.
Yep. Massive
anti-Semite, as you say. Ernest Hemingway, by the way, tried to get Ezra Pound freed early, wrote on his behalf. There you go. But in 1912, in London, at a thing called the Tagore Evening, Ezra Pound met Tagore. He actually sat at his feet. He was apparently a huge fan, which is ironic given the Tagore's outspoken stance against nationalism.
Ezra Pound was a complex character, but he was also a complete dickhead.
Yep. Spent a lot of time in the madhouse.
Yeah, in the loony bin, yeah, totally did.
Well, you'd skirted me, but didn't quite.
Good. Get I only wanted to graze you.
So, I mean, Interpol, we've talked about, took a huge influence from New Order.
Mm-hmm.
Funnily enough, in an interview with LA Weekly, they were chatting to Peter Hook of New Order. They were talking about, oh, you know, back at the turn of the century, there was a load of bands that sounded like New Order. How do you feel about that? And he said, well, I don't mind it. Again, it has to be taken as a compliment. When Carlos left Interpol, they did an internet application for him to be a bass player. I applied and didn't get picked.
That's pretty cool.
I applied.
I wonder if Dave Pajo applied on that. That's weird.
That's weird, isn't it?
Yeah. Or did he just get a nod?
Yeah, I'm not sure. So, New Order. New Order were one of the 70s and 80s bands that appeared on Ready Player One, Steven Spielberg's.
Or New Order, a 70s band?
No, it's 70s and 80s.
One of the bands from the 70s.
70s and 80s.
Right, okay, sorry.
That appeared on Ready Player One,
David,
which is like this big retro gaming thing. Am I just doing the exact same as you?
We better not be.
I fucking hate you guys. By the way, seriously, do you guys like share a flat? Share a bed?
Continue.
This keeps happening.
Also appearing on that soundtrack include Prince, Tears for Fears, Bruce Springsteen, blah blah
David,
blah.
Prince is in it. You should have known Mark was going to go this way. Come on, the fuck.
But also, I've never seen this film, but apparently appearing in that film, there's lots of like retro gaming shit and all that. I don't know. And one of the retro gaming people that are things that appears in Ready Player One is Sonic the Hedgehog.
Okay.
Am I going down a different
route? I was most worried about the Steven Spielberg thing, but...
All right, no. No, I'm going down the Sonic the Hedgehog
absolutely
route.
Absolutely fine.
Because Sonic the Hedgehog, obviously, classic Sega Mega Drive Genesis game.
And a fucking horrendous-looking movie.
Well, yeah, so the new movie is coming out next year. They've actually taken it back in to redesign Sonic the Hedgehog.
It's so minging.
But they're not...
Almost as bad as cats.
But they are... They're not redesigning... Dr. Robotnik, who is going to be played by Jim Carrey.
Interesting.
Now, Jim Carrey...
Seems more like a Nick Nolte.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know, but... I mean, he was in the trailer, and he's just interesting. But Jim Carrey recently got in a little Twitter spat when he talked about fascism and said that fascism leads to people hanging on lampposts.
Yeah.
It led to one reply from a certain Alessandra Mussolini, the granddaughter of Benito Mussolini, who just replied with, "You are a bastard," which is just fantastic. So Jim Carrey versus Mussolini was a thing that we never thought would happen.
No.
But Mussolini met...
That should be an unlockable level in Street Fighter.
Yeah, exactly, I know. Mussolini met Tagore in 1924 in London. And Tagore said some kind of nice things about him as well, actually, funnily enough. But
wow.
At the time, it was before he got involved with the whole war.
The whole fascism.
Oh, yeah. So... Here's my nexus. The song Obstacle Number 1 was the second single from Turn On The Bright Lights. The video was directed by Floria Sigismundi, and she was recently brought on board to direct the Steven Spielberg produced film The Turning. I believe it's her directorial feature film debut. The Turning is based on a novella by Henry James called Turn of the Screw, and Henry James was actually nominated for the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1911, 1912 and 1916. And Tagore was the first non-European writer to win the prize in 1913.
Oh, that was short and sweet.
Right, okay.
Pretty good.
Functional.
All right. Well, there we are.
That was... Right. I'll emotionally recover from that. Mark, it's your choice next week. Who would you like us to talk about?
So next week we're going to do Figure Eight by Elliot Smith.
Elliot Smith.
Yeah.
He's pulled the trigger.
Yeah, I think we're going to do it at some point. And we had a brief discussion about it a couple of weeks ago.
We've talked about him a few times.
Yeah, but we actually had a weird discussion about it where... It seems as though we've kind of both come to the same opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's going to be. I mean, I've got 2 weeks in a row of indie music that all my friends like, and I've never given a fuck about it. So that's exciting.
Suck it up.
So this will be interesting. I mean, it's we'll talk about why Elliot probably is not unsung, but it'll be interesting to talk about his legacy and how we now react to him as fully grown adult males. So it should be
draw our nexus.
Pick a name.
How are we going to get from Elliot Smith to
da, 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 da. Mowgli from the Jungle Book.
Mowgli from the Jungle Book. Who suggested that?
Me.
Oh, well done, Mark.
Fucking hell.
That's fine.
That will actually probably not be that hard.
I don't know. Let's wait and see.
Yeah.
We'll see. We can meander, go down some interesting roads. Mm-hmm.
I need to pee. Can we wrap this up? It is time for me to go and empty my bladder.
Okay, thanks.